Beware, I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long way to go.
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the April 2013 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane Armonroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, folks, we've obviously been several months behind in getting the show out, and I do apologize. Life sometimes gets in the way. But we are back this month with a continuation of the Commodore 64 anniversary special. This month, we're going to be looking at what makes any platform the great platform that it may be, and that is the software. The Commodore 64 featured some of the greatest software ever made on any computer or platform, and we are going to salute all of that great software, the developers, and even the publishers that were behind some of these fantastic titles. I also go around the globe to find out what some of the other countries think of the Commodore 64's top titles. All of this and much more this month right here on Retro Gaming Radio. This month we continue our look at the Commodore 64, celebrating its nearly 35th anniversary. The Commodore 64, aside from being amazing hardware and having a very rich history, two of the topics we've already covered, the Commodore 64 also has a very rich software library and continues to have new software developed even today. What makes this segment so hard to put together, and one of the reasons the show slipped a month or two, is it's really hard to do this part of the Commodore 64's anniversary special any sort of justice, because there really are so many games. And in my studies of Commodore 64 gaming versus practical application, I've also found that there's a great diversity of what people loved in other countries versus our own. Now, most of this show will be talking, of course, about the United States and America's Commodore 64 base and software and publishers. But I found it interesting when I asked Lemon64's forums, I posed to them, given these publishers, what are your favorite games? And I covered all the big publishers, the ones we're going to talk about today. And so many of them came back with, oh, those are all American publishers. You know, we want to give you our favorite games from this publisher and this publisher and that publisher. And I thought it was very interesting the diversity of what constituted popular games here versus there. So we're going to be looking at that as well. And, of course, we'll be regaling stories of my own personal Commodore 64 gaming history as well. So just how many games are there on the Commodore 64? I find that an interesting question, and one that's very difficult to find out any particular answer to. Oddly enough, according to MobyGames.com, which is one of my favorite resources for looking this sort of thing up, Moby Games list 3,221 games for the Commodore 64. Now, we all know that there's many more than that, but that's just Moby Games' list. Now, they also show that there are 1,100 publishers, 1,100 different publishers that have published Commodore 64 games. Now, I'm sure several of those are individuals or one- or two-man teams, but it's still pretty amazing. According to Wikipedia, they cite about 10,000 games for the Commodore 64. I could buy that being a closer number. So then I turn to the absolute hugest list of games on the planet, GameBase. Now, GameBase has been putting together these lists for some time, and according to GameBase, the Commodore 64, all total, with all the software that they have available, and this is games and edutainment, their list is 23,500 games, and hundreds more are in their queue to be vetted and added to the list. That's crazy. So somewhere between 10,000 and 24,000 games exist out there for the Commodore 64. That's an amazing number. Now, obviously, they're not all AAA titles, but I would think that it would be safe to say that it's probably one of the largest, if not the largest, platform of home computer video games before, you know, Windows PC. We're going to start off with the apps. Now, here's the funny thing. When I was making this list, I was thinking to myself, what apps mean something to me? And then I started thinking about other people. What would other people find interesting? And what it turned out to be is most of people, when they think of apps for the Commodore 64 or application software, they think of copying software. You ask people, what are your favorite applications for the Commodore 64? Oh, Fast Hack'em, Superkit, blah, blah, blah. And I thought that was interesting that the plethora of popular software that was out for the Commodore 64 in terms of applications turned out to be copy software. That's not to say, though, that the Commodore 64 did not have some decent gems. Now, a lot of people really liked Print Shop and those sort of card-making, banner-making type packages. There was a number of those out there. Broderbund produced the Print Shop, and in my travels of trying to accumulate Commodore 64 software and hardware, I've noticed that a lot of the lots that I bid on or purchase or just look at seem to contain Print Shop. So Print Shop must have been an entirely, in its own right, a force to be reckoned with on the Commodore 64. Now, it's worth noting that I believe it originally started off on the Apple II. And that makes sense because Apple IIs were in the school system. And in the school system, making banners and things like that would make sense. Posters. And I remember my own high school experience and that we also had Apple IIs. They had multiple copies of the Print Shop you could check out in the media center and actually use. So I would say Print Shop definitely is on one of the top apps of the Commodore 64. It would be journalistically irresponsible not to discuss Geos. Geos, you sort of have a love or hate relationship with Geos. Geos essentially was the early Mac OS, the black and white OS, essentially that on the Commodore 64. It was one of those interesting software packages that added a graphic user interface, mouse pointer, word processing. Geos had a huge following. And if you were really interested in taking the leap from video game Commodore 64 playing to serious Commodore 128 business application, Geos was the likely path. And again, Geos allowed you to use mice or pointing devices. They allowed you to use the native features of the Commodore 128, the 1571 disk drive. They let you use memory expanders in a useful way. There were people that I knew that moved forward from the Commodore 64. They bought a high-end 128. They bought four 1571 drives, a mouse and the whole bit, and they existed inside of a pre-Amiga, you know, sort of a black and white Mac environment, and they loved it. And there was tons of software that came out for it that required Geos to run, and it was a very, very popular thing. Now, as a 15, 16-year-old kid at the time that the Commodore 64 was in my heyday, I really had no interest in Geos. But I had a lot of older friends that were experimenting with it and that were looking at it and using it day to day. So Geos would probably be outside of, I'm still going to give Print Shop the nod for being the most popular, but I would say Geos falls right up underneath that. There was a very interesting group that put out, I wish I had their names written down, I totally blew it on that one. They created this Pocket series, Pocket Writer, Pocket Spreadsheet, Pocket, essentially they were trying to be sort of the office of the Commodore 64. The fun part about this is they started off using the moniker Paperback. And Paperback Writer is like the greatest name for a word processor ever. I mean, that's it. It's unbelievable how perfect that name is. Maybe a little too perfect, because within a year, Paperback Writer turned into Pocket Writer. Now, I don't necessarily know there was a lawsuit involved or there was any legalese behind it. Perhaps they just realized that paperback calc or paperback presenter or whatever didn't have quite the same smooth sound as paperback writer, and they tried to change the moniker so that it made more sense for their other applications. All I know is paperback writer was, that was sort of like I had to have it. And I did. I had a copy of Paperback Writer. I don't think I ever bought it, which is, that's so sad. I look back and I think of all the money I've stolen from people over the years by pirating Commodore 64 software, which is why now I'm trying to, you know, make good and own originals of all this stuff that I grew up with. But Paperback Writer was not just a great name. It was also a great piece of software. Paperback Writer offered you 80 column mode. It had a spell checker. It had everything that, you know, modern type word processors would have. And it was a very good package on its own, and as were all of the other packages. But I was only really interested in word processing for writing, you know, reports for school or whatever. So Paperback Writer not only had an interesting history, but also was a really darn good piece of software as well. Next up, Sid Player. Now, I'm telling you, these were the days of music. The Commodore 64 was really the first home computer that had a synthesizer built into it. You could really do unbelievable things, as you know. If you're a Commodore 64 aficionado, you know exactly what I'm talking about. The Commodore 64 was capable of amazing musical prowess. And the interesting part about it is they sort of went in two directions, right? We've talked about this on the show before, but it's all pertinent to the discussion. There were two types of Commodore 64 music. One is what you would consider original compositions or video game music. These are the Rob Hubbards. These are, I'm trying to think of a couple of other names that pop out. These are the authors or the musicians that created some of the music for some of the greatest games out there for the Commodore 64. I wish I had another list of them. I wasn't planning on talking a lot about music this episode. But that's the original compositions. And then when Quantum Link came around, the online service that a lot of Commodore 64 people were hooked up into, there became another batch of music or musicians that would do covers and some original music using a package called Sid Editor. And Sid Editor was not free. It was like $15 by a guy named Craig Chamberlain, who I actually hooked up with on email a few years back, and I wanted to tell him what an impact it made on my life, and if he realized, you know, how much he changed so many people, and he was a very gracious guy, very nice guy. We chatted. And this Sid Editor would let you create amazing works of musical art. Later on, they added a lyrics display to it. They added all sorts of stuff to this Sid Player type environment. And the best part is Sid Player was free. So you could listen to the SIDs that were made without having to pay. But if you wanted to write them, then you had to buy the software. Perfectly executed model. Everybody had Sid Player. I currently have tons of discs filled with Sid Player and Sid music just waiting to be played. And it was mostly covers, right? Covers of popular 80s songs, 70s songs. And there were several artists that really stood out. So while one group of people, when you talk about Commodore 64 music, are in the high voltage Sid collection category, that's where all of the original music, video game music went. Then you also had the other side, the Quantum Link side, which is where all of these covers and all of this Sid Player music ended up going. So I was a Sid Player guy. I am still a Sid Player guy. I am more interested in covers or songs that I had heard from Sid Player at that time. Things like Axel F was huge. They released a version of Axel F that played on two different Sid Players. So if you had two Commodore 64s, you put one disc, you know, you put Axel F left in one computer, you put Axel F right on the other computer, and you started Sid Player at the exact same time with that song in it, and you would actually get a true stereo version of Axel F. It was very creative, it was very cool, touched a lot of people's lives. So Sid Player is definitely on top of my list of applications that made the Commodore 64 stand out. The last of the applications, I know you guys are dying for me to get to the games, and I'm getting there. The last piece of software I want to talk about is something that not a lot of people know about, that my good friend John Barta, who I've talked about numerous times on the show, turned me on to. This was a piece of terminal software. In other words, software you would use on your Commodore 64 to access a bulletin board system, a BBS. It was called Sixth Sense, and it was made by Rick Sterling, who, by the way, is also responsible for that really cool version of The Entertainer that I played for you a couple shows back. So the Sixth Sense was just a simply an amazing terminal program. I mean, for those of you who may not be familiar with it, maybe you've used Telnet today, where essentially it's a command line interface, and you interface with another computer through simple commands typed in. It's kind of like that. But what Sixth Sense did is it really was made for the power user, right? For example, if you were reading an email or a posting, a public posting on a bulletin board, and you read through it, and then you hit reply, and then it said, you know, type in your subject, you type in your subject, and then it would bring up the next piece of the window to let you actually enter your reply, you didn't have access to the original message, right? So you had to kind of remember what you were replying to. Now, with Sixth Sense, it had a virtual buffer that wrapped around. It was like 1,000 lines that would wrap over themselves, right? So once you filled up 1,000 lines of this buffer, it would start slowly chewing away at the top of the buffer, right? So it was this circular virtual buffer. Anyway, what really made this great is 1,000 lines was a lot. I mean, that was a lot of time. I mean, there were times when I could log into a BBS, do a couple pieces of work, and then leave and still not have filled the buffer. So 1,000 lines was long. But let's say that you were getting ready to compose that reply and you couldn't remember. Using a simple key combination, you could scroll backwards on the buffer and actually see what had already gone past, and you'd be like, oh, well, there you go, that was it. And then you scroll back to the bottom, type, scroll back up, oh yeah, I forgot about that, scroll back down, type. It sounds very archaic by today's standards, but for those who are trapped using some of this other horrible bulletin board or terminal software that came with their modem, this was amazing. It was also one of the first and maybe most comprehensive packages to have macros. Now, there were a lot of other competitive software out there that had auto login scripts, right? So the scripts would watch for the first name, last name, password, and then log you in. That's not what I'm talking about. These macros were insane. They're almost like modern email filters, right? So it would watch for this and do this if that, right? So these macros were almost like little programming languages. It didn't have to be in order, right? So you could have a generic macro that worked on 4 or 5 different BBSs. Maybe they asked for the last name first. Maybe they asked for a username instead of a first name, last name. Whatever it was, these macros could work sort of in parallel. It was really, really cool. It was really cutting edge at the time. It still is cutting edge, in my opinion. It was totally amazing. I used a really clean font. It's amazing how much more pleasant your online experience can be if you're just using a font that's just a little clearer. So the Sixth Sense package is absolutely fantastic. I managed to find... in fact, what's really interesting about Sixth Sense is good luck finding out anything about it. I mean, you could go searching on Google right now for Sixth Sense terminal software or Sixth Sense Rick Sterling. You could search for these things and find practically nothing. And the things that you do find are probably me talking about it or asking other people for information. I ran across the manual, the physical manual for Sixth Sense. Unfortunately, the original disc was not in there, only a copy. So part of my C64 bucket list is to actually get my hands on a copy, the real disc of Sixth Sense. If I could ever find Rick Sterling, I bet he could hook me up. But I have looked. All right, well, that's enough of this app talk. Let's get on to the games. We're going to start off by talking about the companies that matter. Now, again, my apologies to my UK and my European brethren. This focuses a lot on American software companies, but we are going to discuss later on what some of the items you came up with were on the Lemon 64 forums, and we're going to try to get some good coverage for everybody. There were a handful of companies that developed software for the Commodore 64, some from the very beginning, some fell into place a couple of years after the unit came out. But suffice to say that if you were in America anyway, the companies that really mattered on the Commodore 64 were, in no particular order, Electronic Arts, Epix, Access Software, Activision, Cosme, Infocom, SSI, Synapse, Broderbund. Those were really, especially if you look back to the first couple of years of the Commodore 64 software lifecycle, those were the companies that put out all of the AAA games. And we're going to go one by one and look at these companies and talk about their claims to fame and what made them so great and talk about some of the games that they put out. Then I also have a list of what I call one-off games, which is interesting because some of these one-off games actually align themselves with the Lemon 64 people from the UK and from other countries. So let's start with Electronic Arts. Now, before Electronic Arts turned out to be the evil demons that they are now, Electronic Arts was really a cultural mecca for programmers. They seemed to, all of their packaging had bios of their programmers, pictures of their programmers. They included their programmers in the actual promotional materials for their software. It was really driven by the developers, and EA really was a publisher that just sat back and let these magicians do what they needed to do to make great software. I truly believe EA lost their way when they stopped cultivating talent and tried to be the talent. But that's another discussion altogether. So let's talk about Electronic Arts. A lot of people, when they think of Electronic Arts, there's a couple of titles that immediately pop to mind. Titles such as Archon, Mule, Adventure Construction Set, Racing Destruction Set, Pinball Construction Set, Skate or Die, Legacy of the Ancients, right? That's one of my favorite. Bard's Tale, Battle Chess. Listen, I could sit and talk all day long about Electronic Arts and what they brought to the table. But I'm only going to talk about a handful of them. Because honestly, there's only a handful of them that I had really a deep connection with. For example, Mule is one that everybody loves Mule. Never got into it, never liked it. I booted it up to listen to the theme song. And once I got an isolated version of the theme song in SID format, I never needed to boot it up again. And I'll be honest with you, I'm one of the weird outcasts that did not find Mule that attractive of a game. However, Archon holds a great history for me because the software development company that I put together, Dark Unicorn Productions, in the Amiga days, directly owes its name strictly to Archon. Archon was is a fantasy chess game where the pieces actually fight each other for the square. Now, I'm sure there was at least a little bit of basis from Star Wars, right? The whole Star Wars fighting chess game. And in fact, I'm pretty sure I read in some review or article somewhere that they definitely mentioned that as some form of an inspiration, if you will. But Archon was great. You had a light side and a dark side. Different characters on each side. And you also had a game board that shifted in color. Some of the squares would remain white or black throughout the course of time. But over time, a lot of the other squares would change. They would shift from white to dark, and then somewhere in between, grays, multiple gray colors. Now, what made this great was you actually had to fight for your piece. Now, each of the characters had certain limitations. They could only move a certain way or do certain things. But once you landed on a square with an enemy piece on it, the board would blow up to this big fighting arena, and the two of you would go at it, like slug it out. Sometimes it was really, really sad. Like if you took a unicorn against, what was the pawn on the dark side? I don't remember off the top of my head. But that was a quick and decisive death. In order to make the game a little more fair, the color of square that the piece stood on, or that the pieces fought on, would actually dictate who was more powerful. For example, let's say you had a little peon from the dark side standing on a dark or black square. If you attacked with the unicorn on top of that, yeah, the unicorn shoots this massively fast laser out of his horn. It's almost impossible to lose with a unicorn. But not impossible, because the dark side would have this health bar that would go to the roof because he was standing on a dark square. So it became a whole nother piece, not just a matter of teleporting your unicorn to the back row of the enemy pieces and then destroying them systematically one by one. There were always pieces, such as the shapeshifter on the dark side, that would never, ever, ever, if you were playing against the computer, they would never attack on the light square. They would always stay on a dark square where they had the advantage. So if you did try the little trick where you would take your unicorn and teleport him with your wizard to the back row and start systematically wiping out the back row, eventually you'd get to the shapeshifter. And the shapeshifter was on a dark square. He wouldn't leave it unless he thought there was some sort of an advantage to him. And you would have unicorn versus unicorn because the shapeshifter assumed your shape of the unicorn. He was a dark unicorn, and because he was on a dark square, he had like 3 times the power bar that you did. So really, in essence, the most powerful piece in the Archon gaming world is what I would call the dark unicorn. That's where my software company, Dark Unicorn Productions, got its name from. So I owe Archon a huge kudos and thank you for providing me with gajillions of hours of entertainment. And as a two-player game, it was fantastic. But I also owe them for hooking me up with a great name for my company. One of the other games, of course, that I spent hours upon hours upon hours, month after month playing, was Legacy of the Ancients, which to me still represents my favorite type of role-playing game. Very similar to Ultimas, which a lot of people know. Had a top world view, a top-down world view, but also a three-dimensional dungeon crawling as well. So Legacy of the Ancients, I've talked endlessly about that, but that was a game that really, even today, serves as a huge impact and a reminder of my childhood and a reminder to me what I felt the genre should be like. To me, that defined it, and I've never come across anything that quite does it right, that does it the way Legacy of the Ancients did. Seven Cities of Gold was a game that, again, much like Mule, I'll be honest with you, Seven Cities of Gold was not my game. It was an interesting game. It just wasn't my game. I did keep a copy of it around because it had one of the coolest intros ever. It came up with a piece of parchment and it would play this really cool music, and this feather, this full animated feather, came off the side of the screen, came in and wrote in the words Seven Cities of Gold. It's still amazing to see an 8-bit computer do this. So Seven Cities of Gold is definitely memorable, and I know it has a huge following, much like its follow-up Heart of Africa, which did not have as great of an opening. But to leave Seven Cities of Gold off the EA list would be simply criminal. Adventure Construction Set. My goodness. Adventure Construction Set was an amazing piece of work. First of all, Adventure Construction Set had some of the most memorable music. Little ditties littered throughout the game. Very, very compelling. In fact, if you go and search for, like on YouTube or just on the net, you search for Adventure Construction Set music, you'll find people have done their own renditions. People have made symphony versions of the songs. It's crazy for this little 8-bit game. But Adventure Construction Set was great. It allowed you to actually make your own top-down world-type adventures. It came, I think, with 2 or 3 full adventures already created for you. And then you could actually take all the assets from those 3 games, the graphics, the sounds, the weapons, and you could really go down to the deep, deep level. Let's say that one of the weapons was a sword. Well, let's say you didn't want to call it a sword. You wanted to call it halibard or whatever. You could actually go in there and say, okay, well, this isn't a sword anymore. It's this. And you could change some of the attributes. Let's say you wanted to make a magic sword, right? You could actually create a clone of this sword and make it whatever you wanted. It was unbelievable, the sheer amount of ability that this game gave you to create your own world. And I'm talking a world. I'm not talking about a dungeon. I'm talking about a world map, cities, buildings within cities, rooms within buildings. You could set triggers, right? When a person walked past a spot in a room, you could actually have something happen. There was an event system. It was absolutely mind-blowing, the possibilities that you could do with this. Now, here's the fun part. I don't think I know anybody who actually finished making a complete adventure. Now, there were many of them published, so to speak. People would make their own adventures, build these levels. They would come out as data discs, right? And so they would actually take these discs and put them online, and people could download them and play their adventure. Now, you got to understand, there really wasn't an internet. The best you had were BBSs. And it was really hard to get some sort of a critical mass following of any particular adventure. So, you know, while you spent 500 hours creating an adventure, maybe 50 people got to see it. Your friends, your family, and a couple of people you trade with on a BBS. It wasn't like there was a website that you could go and download endless numbers of adventures for Adventure Construction Set. So what happened was, and I'm guilty of this as well, people would start one. I would go in, I started off and I redid all the assets, right? I think the first thing I wanted to do was a Dragonlance game, right? I wanted to do something based on Dragonlance. So I renamed the assets, I put in NPCs of all the Dragonlance characters and all that stuff. I built a couple of cities, you know, based on the game. But then it's like, man, this is a lot of work. I mean, this is a lot of work. So I stopped. But here was the great part. The game, the Adventure Construction Set system, could generate random games. And some of them were pretty good. I mean, they would generate a whole random world, random cities, random encounters, random everything. And, okay, so there wasn't a huge cohesive story going on. It was a random maze generator, for lack of a better word. But they were fun to play. Well, here was the great part. If you got discouraged, you built all your assets, you built a couple towns, you could tell the game to finish it for you. And it would sit and chug away hour after hour. And you'd be flipping discs like every 15 minutes. Or if you had four drives, you'd be like flopping discs in between them. And eventually, hours upon hours upon hours, change disc, change disc, change disc, change disc, flip the disc over, flip that disc over. But somewhere at the end of that whole thing, this very simple message would come up. And the message would say, your adventure has been created, or something to that effect. It was a very simple message. And at that moment, you realized it was ready to go, and you could jump right into the game and play it. It was the most empowering piece of software I've ever seen, still today. Forget about Visual Studio. Forget about any of this stuff. Adventure Construction Set was the most empowering creativity system I've ever seen anywhere on any platform. So huge kudos. Ultimate Wizard, of course, has a great history behind it. Ultimate Wizard was blatantly a Jumpman ripoff. I mean, if you're a Jumpman fan and you looked at Ultimate Wizard, you'd be like, oh, really? But Ultimate Wizard took it a couple of steps further. They gave you a great level builder, which was fantastic. And they also gave you the ability to cast spells. Now, this was pretty cool. Your little wizard guy that acted as the Jumpman, you'd have to collect all the items from a given level, right? And then there was a key and a door. You'd get the key, you'd open the door, and you could leave. And, of course, the idea was you wanted to rack up some score, rack up some booty. So, bounty. Did I say booty? Because sometimes that happens. I guess booty works, too. Pirate booty. So, anyway, so you start collecting treasures, and you're avoiding obstacles, and you're trying to get to the key, and you could do great things. You could teleport, you could cast Featherfall. Let's say you made a bad jump and you're falling to your death, you could hold down and push the button and cast this Featherfall spell, and you would just gently fall to the next platform. So the game wasn't just a Jumpman ripoff. It had 100 levels. It had an editor. It was a top-notch production. It was one of my favorite ones. And I tortured my friend Troy Tulu next door. If you listen to Passing Your Seat Radio, my sister's show, Troy and I talked about it a couple of shows back. He was here in town, and we went on a long drive and talked about all of our favorite stories. But yeah, Ultimate Wizard was, it had a very distinctive sound when it would build the levels at the beginning. And my friend Troy said that he had endless nightmare after nightmare regarding the sound effects that that game put out. Pinball Construction Set, Bill Budge's Pinball Construction Set was very similar, to other construction sets of the time. It was not something that would build for you, however. It was something that you could, actually build your own pinball machines or use the five or six tables that were included. But unlike Adventure Construction Set, Pinball Construction Set was a little bit faster to develop for. Right now, a good pinball machine takes forever to develop. What these people were putting together were, oh, let's take my favorite song from AC/DC and make a pinball table. Well, yeah, okay, so it played some AC/DC music and okay, it was named AC/DC, but it really wasn't an AC/DC. But what's really interesting, though, is those tables made their rounds a lot more than Adventure Construction Set user-generated levels did. If you go through... Sorry, I had a little yawn there. If you like buy lots of software, like I'm doing for my Commodore 64, you'll find these pinball games. And it's very obvious that they were made with Pinball Construction Set, because you could make standalone tables that didn't require the software. So, you know, it's like, oh, wow, this, I've never even heard of this pinball game. You throw it in there, and it's like, oh, well, it's a Pinball Construction Set game. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. And believe me, you can throw together a table that's halfway fun without spending 12 hours doing it like it would require with Adventure Construction Set. So that gave a lot of people a lot of fun, and there was a lot of... very inventive tables still kicking around if you can get your hands on them. Racing Destruction Set followed in with the same moniker of allowing you to build your own stuff. And of all the construction sets, I think it was more of a track builder than anything. And you could do some fun things with it, but it wasn't really that low level of creativity. But it was fun, though, because you could monkey with things that you'd never been able to monkey with before. You could monkey with gravity. You could monkey with physics and tweak the game. You could actually make a racing game on the moon. You could make a track on the moon. And this would allow you to create jumps that would essentially send the cars flying in the air and really never come down, right? So there was a lot of testing and building and tweaking. But that's one of those games that a lot of people had a lot of fun as a two-player game versus as a construction set. A couple of other objects of note here under EA, Bard's Tale. The Bard's Tale series was very huge. It still is prolific today. They are still making Bard's Tale games. Battle Chess. Battle Chess was a traditional version of chess that featured animated, humorous pieces but followed all the rules of real chess, unlike Archon. And I remember the Commodore 64 version, of course, was fairly plain, but they released a multimedia version of it on CD for PC, for Amiga CD32, and this was great. You could actually watch a movie, essentially, built with the engine, where each of the pieces would come out, introduce themselves, and talk to you, and explain to you their purpose in the game and their hierarchy. And much like Archon, in the respect that the pieces would fight, like for example, if you took a bishop and stole a queen, right, and you took a queen, the bishop had the scepter, right, but the scepter turned into a mace, what do they call the weapon that's on a chain? It's like a mace, but it's on a chain. I don't remember. Anyway, so the guy would, you know, the bishop would pull his mace apart or whatever, and he would beam the queen on the head. She'd fall over, and he'd, like, grab her by the hair and drag her off. It was hilarious. So it was a good game of chess, too. It had a really, I mean, well, I was never great at chess. I could hold my own. But most people who were into chess said that it was a fairly strong game of chess also. So It was a bonus. The last thing about EA I want to talk about before moving on, because I've droned on endlessly about EA, is Skate or Die, which, of course, was ported to the NES and to numerous other platforms. But Skate or Die had an interesting intro screen, right? It had this skater on a skateboard, and it was playing this really cool guitar riff music. It was really neat. It was something that didn't seem quite possible. When you started listening to the music, adding up the voices, and you're going, wait a minute, there's too many voices in here. There should only be three, and I'm hearing like five. So somehow they pulled that off. But the interesting part of that is that guitar riff didn't work properly on some SID chips, right? Some of the later SID chips on the 128D, I think. The 128D had a newer SID chip. And so when you would load it up, the guitar wouldn't really play. You could see where it was supposed to play, but it wasn't really playing. And I always remember that being a huge bummer, because I loved that intro music. Sometimes I'd just boot the game up to listen to the intro music and then shut it off. And that was one I did not have a copy of. But go check it out. Go hit YouTube. Maybe I'll provide you a link for that, being able to hear that intro. That's pretty cool. Again, I don't remember the game being all that great, but I'll tell you what. It was an interesting piece of history from Electronic Arts. Let's move on to Epix. Epix is one of the original gaming companies for the Commodore 64. You'll remember games from them such as Temple of Apshai, Impossible Mission, right? Jumpman. They also published IK Plus, or International Karate Plus. They were responsible for publishing from overseas several games that were huge, like Death Sword, which you may also know as Barbarian, where the two barbarians squared off like Conan style, and you could cut the guy's head off, and the blood would spray out of his neck, and the little green golem guy would come, laugh, and kick the guy's head off the screen. They were also responsible for one of my favorite games, which I'll talk briefly about, Gateway to Apshai. I know, I just mentioned Temple of Apshai. Temple of Apshai was more of a turn-based Dungeons & Dragons style game. Gateway to Apshai was more of a action adventure, if you will, taking you through randomly created dungeons, lots of different creatures, lots of different weapons, hidden doors, hidden traps, all sorts of fun stuff. It was one of my favorite games on the Commodore 64. It also was part of the Commodore 64 DTV package that was released a few years back, the Commodore in a controller type deal you plugged into the screen. So that was great. It was nice to have that available. But the two things that are... Oh, G.I. Joe was another one. G.I. Joe was another game that I just played the living crap out of. And it had great music. G.I. Joe had some of the greatest music of games of the time. And it was actually a fun game, too, but the load times were absolutely insane. But, you know, they had cool little animations for you to watch. That was one of the few games, or the first games, that I remember having something on the screen doing something, an animation of some sort, or some faction of progress indication on the screen while the game was loading. Normally, when the drive kicked on, everything on the screen stopped. But G.I. Joe sort of slipped that, and while you're waiting for the game to load, this you would see like G.I. Joe's headquarters, and a little truck would drive out, and it would play the music, and you know the truck would drive out, and he would drive off the screen, and then if the game wasn't done loading yet, then you'd see the same truck come back out of the building and drive again. So it was like a loading indicator. It was one of the first ones that I personally remember seeing, although it may not have been the first. For many people, Epix is encompassed by two products, Summer Games and the Epix Fast Load cartridge, and we're going to spend some time on both of those. Summer Games was the first thing that I saw on the Commodore 64 that really knocked my socks off, and I'll tell you why. Sometimes it's about presentation, and not just that the games were fun. Some of the games themselves were great. I mean, this was riding off of, like, Track and Field at the arcade. Summer Games gave you a whole bunch of different games like pole vaulting and running, swimming, all this sort of thing. But when the game loaded up, first of all, the title screen of Summer Games, and the same thing with Impossible Mission, too. We'll talk about Impossible Mission a little bit, too, because it's deserving. But that screen that came up was almost like it was higher resolution than the Commodore 64 was capable of showing. Lots of graphic tricks, lots of dithering, lots of shadowing, and you're going, that doesn't look like a Commodore 64 screen. But it was. So when this game loaded, the first thing you got were the opening ceremonies, and you know what I'm talking about. So you get this side view of, I don't know what they call that, the Eternal Flame thing. I'm sorry, I'm not a sports person, what can I tell you? So it'd start playing the music of the Olympics. Da, 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 da. And this guy would come running on the screen, and he had the torch, right? The torch to signal the starting of the games. He ran up the stairs, and this was like super well animated, right? I mean, this guy looked like he was running. It wasn't a stick figure. It looked like a little guy. And he came up there, and he looked at the camera, and he laid the torch down, and the fire took off, and it looked like really cool fire. And all of these doves, these white doves, flew onto the screen, and they were like gorgeously animated, you know, like 30 frames per second, gorgeous animation. And you're going, oh my God, this is the coolest thing ever. You just wanted to watch that opening ceremony over and over again. It was that cool. And then it also turned out to be a fantastic game because it was one of those few games where you could play with four people instead of just two. And you would take turns. Sometimes you would compete against each other, but most of the time you would take turns. So I remember being with my friend Troy. He had two brothers, Brian and Scott. So any game that would let you play four players was great because then we could all play, not just take turns. And that was a cool thing. And plus some of the games were fun. Now, this was the introduction to what I would call the joystick destructive games, where essentially you had to grab the joystick and wiggle it back and forth to run. And in some cases, that caused a lot of damage to joysticks. That's what the Atari 2600 controllers were great for. Those things would take a licking and keep on ticking. They were perfect for the running events in Summer Games. Now, of course, the game series proliferated well beyond Summer Games. Summer Games 2, World Games, California Games, the Games International Edition, the Games Summer Edition, the Games... it's exhausting. They really milked the Games franchise out. And not all of them were that great, to be honest with you. You could tell when they changed teams, and it didn't quite work out as well. But I think it was one of them, I think it was Winter Games, had an ice skating competition. And I remember the music that you ice skated to was a fantastic theme. It was a beautiful theme. And I still remember it. What, 30 years later, I still remember the music from that ice skating event. Impossible Mission, of course, was great because it really was its namesake. The U.S. version of Impossible Mission was actually impossible to finish. It could not be done. In fact, the crackers, I believe it was Eaglesoft, that released Impossible Mission, they actually fixed the game so it was possible to win. You could actually finish the game. But Impossible Mission was a really neat concept. It was a really neat game. And for those of you who may have missed it, I'll just talk about it real briefly. You are trying to stop the end of the world by defusing the super bomb put together by this evil dude, and you're in his underground complex. And it's a side view, right? So you're looking always from a side perspective. And you would call it a platformer if there wasn't so much to do. So you rode this little elevator down, and you could jump, but that's all you could do. You could run and jump. That was all you could do. So you would have to use other things along the way. For example, the whole complex was filled with robots, and these robots would shoot these amazing electrical bolts out of the front. And some of the robots were smart. Some of them were smarter than others. Some would track you. Some would not track you. Some had a pre-chosen path. Some of them would only shoot if they saw you. Some of them would not shoot except for at periodic intervals. So there was a means of strategy here, right? You could use strategy to figure your way out around the robots. Each room, many of the rooms anyway, had a computer terminal where if you could acquire these passes, you could actually disable the robots in the room until you left and came back in. There were other ones where you could, there were these little, lifts, right? These lifts in the room could take you from level to level inside the room. And you needed those lifts to get to certain areas. Well, the lifts, once you've used them, don't reset. So you could use the computer to reset them. But your whole goal was to find pieces of these punch cards. And so you would run through each room and there would be, you know, computers or storage decks or desks or whatever. And you would run to each one of them and push forward on the joystick and quote, quote, search. Now, some items like waste baskets would take like half a second to search. But if you were to search a huge computer desk, for example, it could take you 3-4 seconds for that little search meter to go down telling you what you found. And sometimes you'd find nothing. In the meantime, you're always worried about dodging those dang robots and trying to navigate the room safely to get to those areas that might have an object you can search. Sometimes you would find one of those passes to reset the robots. Most of the time you'd find nothing, but some of the times you'd find a piece of a card. Now, the best way I can describe this is, if let's say you had a piece of paper. Most of you know what punch cards are, right? Most of my listening audience is old enough. Imagine taking a punch card and cutting it up. Or, I don't know, stripping layers off it. It's really hard to explain. Anyway, you would get pieces of these cards, and it became almost like a puzzle. They would have blue cards, yellow cards, green cards, right? And you know all the green ones went together? So you had to lay them down on top of each other. You could rotate and flip them, so that made it even harder. But you could rotate and flip them, and eventually you had to take, I think it was 4 or 6 of these pieces of cards, lay them on top of each other to create an actual punch card. And it was really hard. This was a hard, hard game. And you had, I think, 6 hours of real time to finish the game. Every time you died, you lose 10 minutes of life, 10 minutes of time, right? And one of the things that was great about this game was if you fell into a hole in the room, the guy would scream as he fell down. I remember user group meetings. All we would do is boot this game and make that guy fall in the hole and laugh our asses off over and over and over again at this poor guy we keep dropping in the hole. But Impossible Mission was definitely a huge piece of Commodore 64 history. The last thing about Epics we want to talk about, of course, is the fast load cartridge. This became synonymous. This was the Q-tip of fast load cartridges. Because the honest truth is, there were dozens of fast loading cartridges. Freezing cartridges, fast loading cartridges, utility cartridges, blah, 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 blah. But when you said fast load, you were talking about the Epics fast load cartridge. Now, this was done by a guy named Scott Nelson in 1984. He was also responsible for the Epics Vorpal loader, which was a very, very fast disk loading system, which also happened to work very well as an anti-copying protection scheme. The fast load system also had a built-in DOS wedge, right? If, for those of you who remember back, the Commodore 64 had a really weird way of getting a directory. You'd have to type load, quote, $, quote, $8. It would load it as a program listing, and then you would type list, and you could see what was on the disk. That's horrible. Plus, if you happened to be working on a program at the time, it wiped it out. So this DOS wedge would let you just type in a $ and hit enter, and it would stream without interrupting your program that's in memory. It would stream out a list of what was on the drive. It would also let you do some other things, right? It had a basic machine language monitor. It had a simple disk editor. And it boasted, using just a cartridge, no special kernels or enhancements to the drive or anything, it offered you up to 5 times faster loading. And as long as you weren't doing anything protected, let's say you just had loose games on a disk, it really did put out. I mean, it put out and did its job of 5 times faster loading. People actually modified these too. If you look up on eBay, you'll find Epics fast load cartridges that have reset switches hacked into them. The Epics fast load was the go-to cartridge. I think possibly the greatest success of Epics was the fast load cartridge. Everybody had one. Rich or poor, hacker or legitimate user, everybody had a fast load cartridge. Let's move on to Access Software. This was Access Software, originally anyway, was created by a couple of brothers, Carver brothers. Bruce Carver was one, and the name of the other guy eludes me at the moment. I didn't write it in my notes. But Access Software really upped a few things in the Commodore 64. Just crazy. First of all, they were one of the first real proponents of digital speech. Now, we talked about Impossible Mission. Impossible Mission did have some synthesized speech, and there were a couple of other titles that did too. But for the most part, the most memorable digital speech I remember from Commodore 64 games came from Access Software. Access did a lot of sports stuff and war stuff. Sports and war were the bread and butter of Access Software. Leaderboard golf, which, yeah, like, leaderboard golf was the golden tee golf of the 80s. Leaderboard golf was a realistic golf simulator, not just because it would let you pick your drivers or pick your clubs or things like that. This actually rendered real life three-dimensional golf courses, real golf courses. And they made five or six different leaderboard golfs, as I remember. There was a couple of them that allowed, I'm just talking out of my tail end at this point. Leaderboard golf was great. The golfer looked real. He swung real. It added a new feeling for golfing. It was really, really amazing what those boys managed to pull out of the Commodore 64. Now, granted, it took like a minute to draw each hole, but you know what? You know, you want realism, it's going to cost you. They also were the creators of one of my favorite of, I guess you would call it a sports game on the Commodore 64, 10th Frame Bowling. That game just blew me away. It still blows me away that a Commodore 64 is doing that. It was a realistic three-dimensional bowling game. It was sort of a third person behind the shoulder, and you would bowl, and the bowler looked real. It was just like leaderboard golf. The guy looked real. And you could do things like, you know, spins and backspins, all the things that you would do in real bowling. And then add to that the pins, the pin action. You know, anybody who's into bowling knows that the part that really separates a shareware bowling game from a top-notch AAA bowling game are the pin physics and the realistic physics of the strike, of the ball hitting the pins. And I'm telling you, for being a Commodore 64 with like a 1 megahertz CPU and the whole bit, 10th Frame Bowling really did make it look like an Amiga. It really did. And of course, you could play multiple players, you could have league bowling, all this sort of stuff. What a lot of people remember the most about Access Software was, I believe, one of their first games, which was called Beachhead. Now, I remember loading Beachhead from tape, and loading Beachhead from tape took 22.5 minutes. And the reason I know that is because the game itself said, now loading Beachhead, you know, come back in 22.5 minutes. There you go. Beachhead was a multi-level war game, and it was fantastic. I mean, I remember seeing the magazine ads for this thing, and it looked like, it was insane. It looked like a whole new computer, and that's, I think, what Access was trying to do. They were trying to up the ante of what a Commodore 64 game could look like. I mean, you were in control. I remember the first level of that. You were in control like a 50 cal anti-aircraft gun, and the aircraft would fly in from the background. They would actually fly in and make strafing passes over you. And you had control of the gun, and it was simply amazing. The sound effects, the boomings of the cannons and everything was insane. It was a fantastic game. Followed, of course, up with Beachhead 2, which really introduced a ton of speech and a whole bunch of unbelievably gorgeous-looking graphics. They're also responsible for Raid Over Moscow, which is one of my favorite war games. Raid Over Moscow was just insane. Once again, they took the Commodore 64 and pushed it beyond what you thought was even possible on a Commodore 64. And finally, lesser known from Access, which is odd, and not really odd because Epic's Fastload had this market tied down, Access Software actually created their own fast loader cartridge called the Mach 5. And the Mach 5 had a whole bunch of other stuff built into it. It came out really close to the same time as fast load, and I was unable to find out who was first to market. But Mach 5 also used the same sort of 5x fast loader. It also had a wedge. It also had a file manager built into it, which fast load did not. It had a file catalog tool for cataloging your discs, which was useful back then. And it even had a memory extender, which would let you give you a few extra bytes of memory to do other cool stuff with. It was really a decent cartridge, but unfortunately, like I said, Epic's Fastload had that market all tied up. Before Activision turned into the whores that they are today, Activision also was responsible for some of the more interesting 8-bit games that have come out. Now, probably what most people remember from Activision on the Commodore 64 is David Crane's Immortal Ghostbusters, which was not only a great game, but had a great intro. It had humor built into it. It was simply an amazing game. And those of you who've listened to the show for a long time know I interviewed David Crane, and we talked at great lengths about Ghostbusters and how he, you know, how he wrote it, the whole deal with Sony. It's worth listening to. But you'll also remember something called Little Computer People. This was sort of like The Sims before The Sims. This was also a David Crane item. And you were in charge of a house. And there was a little guy that lived in the house. And it was a side view, right? Like if you were to take a house and cut away the side, you could see all the, it was two floors and you had rooms. There was a bedroom, a bathroom, a kitchen, a living room. And this little guy just lived in there. And your job was to kind of observe and interact with him from time to time. It was a very quirky game, very non-standard. It was very non, what I would call hardcore gaming. But it was a fascinating study. This little guy would live. And his time was your time. So when you booted up the game, now remember the Commodore 64 had no real-time clock, right? So every time you booted the game, you would tell him what the date was and what time it was. And it would mimic your own time. So if it was, if you for some reason were on your computer at midnight and you got into Little Computer People, he'd be asleep. And you could do things to help the guy out, right? You could send him food. You had to send him food. And you could control certain elements in there, right? Like he'd sit down in the living room chair and you could push like control P and this little robotic arm would come out and pat him on the back and he'd look at the screen and he'd smile at you. And you could send him records. He would go, you could send him music and he would play music. You could ask, you could type him a letter and say, you know, will you please play the piano? And if you typed in certain pieces like Für Elise or Beethoven or whatever, there were certain songs that he knew. And he would play those for you on the piano. It was a fascinating, it was a little more cerebral, I guess, than most of the games that were out at the time. Which is not unusual, because one of my favorite games that Activision published was a game called Alter Ego. And Alter Ego, I've talked about on the show a million times, of course, but Alter Ego is a question and answer situational life simulator. You would start from birth. First of all, the game, if you will, would open by asking you like 30 questions, and you would say true or false to the questions. And they would build a basic personality profile about you based on those 30 questions. And they had these spheres of influence, right? Physical, social, emotional, intellectual. And these spheres would fill as you would progress through life. And so you would start off as an infant. And you had very few choices, right? So you went through the first, I don't know, 10 situations. And they were really simple. You know, there's a bright object in front of you. What do you do? Do you cry? Do you reach for it? And then based on what you answer, they might ask you another question. And then, boom, you'd be through that experience. And as you move forward in life, you start off as an infant, you got to early childhood, then you got to the teen years, then you got young adulthood, adulthood, and then old age, right? So you could, once you played through the game a couple times, they would unlock all of them for you, but initially you had to go through each stage. And you could die. I mean, sometimes you would just up and die. Sometimes a freak accident, you're 24 years old, and you're playing baseball, and a pop fly ball hits you on the head and kills you. I mean, and the game's over. And you're like, what the hell just happened there? But most of the time, it didn't try to make any judgments. I mean, literally, you could be a drug user. You could be a womanizer. You could do all sorts of things in this game that were not exactly nice. And the game wouldn't judge you on it, per se, but your life and your spheres would take impact on these things. It was a fascinating game. It took forever. They released, and here's the fun part, they released a male and a female version. So I found it more interesting personally as a male who'd already been through a lot of these life experiences to go through and play as a woman and see what sort of life experience things that they had to deal with or what they had to go through. It was written by five or six psychologists, psychiatrists. It was a very cerebral game, and you can actually get it on mobile devices now. You could actually play it in your spare time on your mobile device or your tablet. So very cool. Alter Ego. They were also responsible for, and I'd be remiss in my duties if I didn't mention this game, a game called Toy Bazaar. And my friend Troy and I played a lot of Toy Bazaar. Toy Bazaar is a fantastic game. It's a platformer. It's quirky. It's weird. It's fun. Just try it out. I mean, I'm not going to talk at great lengths about it, but you're in a toy factory, and essentially you have to disable. There are toys running amok, and you have to disable the toys. It's one single-screen, non-scrolling platformer, but it was really, really fun. And I've never seen any game quite like it, which makes it even more special. Let's move on to Cosme. Now, Cosme is not a name that a lot of people would associate with the Commodore 64, simply because they put out a lot of budget software. I don't think any of their games were more than $15, which was perfect, because I was like 15, and $15 was about what I could spend on games. Probably the most famous of the Cosme games, of course, was Forbidden Forest. Now, Paul Norman was responsible for most of the great stuff in Cosme, at least in the early years. Later on, Cosme expanded into a budget shareware type of a system where they would publish clip art and fonts and things like that. But in the early days, they were strictly games, and most of Cosme's stuff came from Paul Norman, who I've interviewed on the show before. Great guy. Forbidden Forest was a game that, we'll talk about some of the other ones too, briefly, but Forbidden Forest is the big one, right? Forbidden Forest had you an archer in this creepy, dark, scary forest. It was a side-to-side scroller where your archer remained in the middle and the world moved around you. And it had multiple levels. On the first level, these giant spiders would come after you. There were skeletons with spears. There were giant frogs coming in from the back. There was a huge bumblebee, a fire-breathing dragon, and, of course, the end, the Demogorgon. This was a scary game. I mean, it was a bloody game. I mean, when the monsters got you, I mean, there's blood everywhere. It was just this, oh my God. I mean, this is like, you know, Game of Thrones for the Commodore 64, you know? There's gore everywhere. There was no sex or nudity, but, you know, it was what I would definitely call one of the first mature games. And it was fun. I mean, and there was some of it was just creepy. On the skeleton level, these skeletons would chase after you with these spears. And the goal of that level, sometimes you just had to kill, like, the spiders, you had to kill, like, six spiders, and you'd pass that level. The bee level, you'd have to kill the bee. On the dragon level, you'd have to kill the dragon, which was a lot harder than it sounds. But on this skeleton level, you had an objective, and the objective was not only to not get stabbed by the skeletons, but there was also this creepy death hooded figure floating in the background of the forest, and your job on that level was to put an arrow in the face of this ghoul. And the cool thing was, is not only could you kind of control the pitch of the arrow, but you could also control how high up the arrow went. It was sort of an innovative system for control. And so to put an arrow in that guy's face was complicated, especially the whole time you're being chased after by a skeleton, or multiple skeletons, in fact. Forbidden Forest was the first game that Troy and his brothers and I spent a lot of time together, and he had, we lived in Wenatchee, Washington, and he had relatives over in Davenport, Washington, which is close to Spokane, if you want to pull up a map. So I was invited to go over with them to Davenport to visit the relatives, right? So we, of course, we packed a Commodore 64 with us, and a bunch of games and controllers. We were ready for the weekend. And we went shopping at Sears. And Sears had this Forbidden Forest game on cassette tape in a display case for $15. So we each of us had like $5. We put our money together. We got this game. We got it home, and loading off of tape, of course, takes forever. When that game comes up and it plays, it has that title screen and that music, we sat there with our mouths hanging open. I mean, that was just that insane and incredible at the time. We actually played that game in shifts all weekend long. I would play for a couple of hours, then I would go to sleep and let Troy get up, and then Troy would wake Scott up, and Scott would get up and play, and then Brian would get up and play. It was insane, sleeping in shifts to play frickin' Forbidden Forest. It was absolutely amazing. But yeah, that's still one of those games where I can load it up and go, man, this represents my childhood. Several other great games came out. A fun Q-Bert game called Slinky. Super Huey, which was an amazingly detailed helicopter simulator. I mean, it was hard. It was a hard simulator. And of course, my favorite Indiana Jones knockoff, Caverns of Kafka, which puts you in these great chambers looking for these five magic stones. And the game kind of sucked once you learned how you could fly by doing multiple jumps one after the other. But it was very creepy and spooky and scary, and there were screaming things, and it was cool. I mean, it was like grown-up games at that point in time. Let's talk about Infocom. Everyone knows Infocom, right? Zork was, of course, the big one that everybody remembers. Infocom made their living using interactive fiction. And when I say interactive fiction, early Infocom games were 100% prose. No graphics, no joysticks. Your mind was the game. And in these Infocom games, they had really good writers. I mean, the story writers alone could easily have written books. But essentially, there were many text adventure games out at the time that were very, very basic. Right, so it would set up a scene. You are in a field. There is a house to the east. What do you want to do? And you would type, go east. And it would say, okay, you are standing by the house now. There is a path to the west and a door to the house to your north. Go north. Okay, you have entered the house. There is nothing going on here, but there is a sword sitting in the chair. What do you want to do? Get sword. Okay, you have the sword. You know, that was what early text adventures were, right? Infocom made books into these games. And Zork, of course, is the most popular. But you could use full sentence commands. And you could do things that it just shouldn't seem possible to do. You know, I mean, sure, you could use, you know, like, get sword, go north. But you could do multiple things, right? You could say, open the mailbox, take out the letter, and then close the mailbox. And it would say, mailbox, you open the mailbox, you took out the letter, and you close the box. I mean, you could stack commands. But then you could do crazy things, like these huge, long sentences. And most of the time, a lot of the time, it'd be like, oh, okay, you got it. And you're thinking to yourself, there's like 160K of data on this disk, right? It was a single-sided disk. But somehow, they put an entire book on that disc with every possible, it's like choose your own adventure on steroids. But how did they fit that on one disc? I still don't know the answer to that. I'm 43 years old. I still haven't figured out how they managed to put an entire book on a 160K disc. But the one that always stuck in, there were two games that stuck in my head, and they were not the most popular of the Infocom games. They were still both prose games. Infocom eventually started adding graphics and things to the games, but the two that I remember the most are Deadline, which was a murder mystery game where you played a detective. And the other one was called Leather Goddesses of Phobos, which was a PG-13, slightly racy game. And considering I remember them like 30 years later, I guess it's a testament to the holding power of a couple of these games. Deadline blew me away because it was one of the first games that I remember you could do something that you shouldn't really be able to do, and it understood what you were doing. For example, in Deadline, for those of you who played it, you might fondly remember some of this stuff. At the beginning of Deadline, you're at a house where a bunch of people have gathered, and a murder has taken place. And there are tons of NPCs that you have to actually like follow around the house and talk to at the right times and things like that. Well, one of them was named Mrs. Rourke. I think she was the widow. And so you would question her and you'd ask her about this, ask her about that, blah, blah, blah. And then she'd eventually take leave of you and like go to another room. And it would tell you when she left the room, be like, Mrs. Rourke has gone into the kitchen. Right. So then you would say, you know, follow Mrs. Rourke. And they would know that that meant go to the kitchen. You didn't have to type go to kitchen or go west or whatever. So you go in the kitchen and Mrs. Rourke is there. So, you know, you have entered the kitchen, blah, blah, blah. Mrs. Rourke is here preparing hors d'oeuvres or whatever. And you're a detective, right? So I'm thinking, I wonder what would happen if I raped her. Okay. Listen, you're 15 or 16. These weird things go through your head. So I actually typed in rape Mrs. Rourke. And I knew for a fact that the game would say, I don't understand the word rape, but it did. It did. And all of a sudden this huge, big bunch of text comes up and it's like your mind clouds with evil thoughts, blah, blah, blah. And the police come and take you away silently. And I'm going, dude, no way. I can't believe not only did it understand the word, but it also it was planning for it. It planned for the fact that somebody might try to rape this poor woman. So I thought that was simply just genius. Leather Goddess of Phobos was even better because Leather Goddesses would the first thing it would ask you, like, was your age, right? And so as human beings, our first response is to tell the truth. Right, so it's like, how old are you? I'm 16. Hit enter. I know what it was. There were three different game modes. There was like normal, racy, and lewd. You know, and lewd mode was the most, you know, the highest level. And so you could say, you know, change to lewd mode, and it would say, how old are you? Type in 16. It's like, nope, that is an unacceptable age for lewd mode. You know, access denied to lewd mode. And so you'd say, again, you'd think, oh, this is easy enough. Enter lewd mode. How old are you? 21. No, you're not. You just said me you were 16. And it was like, oh, damn. Well, they're on the ball. You'd actually, if you wanted to actually get past that, you would actually have to boot the game all up from scratch. And it knew. It knew how old you were. Eventually, it would forget, which was kind of fun. Like, if you played it long enough, you could sneak into lewd mode, and it would say, you know, oh, age is acceptable. You may play. Instead, you know, I think it remembered your, one time we tested, I think it remembered your age for like 20 moves or something. After 20 moves, you could enter lewd mode. But I remember at one point in time, I don't remember anything about the game other than the lewd mode thing. And then you're on the spaceship and you're looking down at what the aliens are doing. And you can ask for more description, or I can't remember what it was, what the command was. But you could say, you know, give me more information or give me more description. And the game comes back and it says, even in lewd mode, we are not able to tell you exactly what you're seeing. However, it does involve a human, some rubber tubing, and a yak or something like that. And it was like the greatest thing ever that these guys had this interactive fiction. So Infocom's definitely holds a great piece of my early teen childhood development. Moving along, SSI, Strategic Simulations Incorporated, I believe was the name. They created one, mostly they're known for their gold box games, right? Most of them were based on Dungeons and Dragons, either Forgotten Realms or Dragonlance or some of the other properties at the time. But before all of that, before the quote gold box games, SSI was also responsible for publishing two of my favorite role-playing games. One of them is Telengard. Now, Telengard, I went back and looked at it recently, in fact, and Telengard, I can't even begin to explain to you how many hours, I mean, tens, dozens, hundreds of hours I must have put into Telengard. And it was a very simple dungeon exploration, level up, rank up, kind of basic Dungeons and Dragons game. But it's simply amazing just how, I don't know, it didn't have a story. All you were doing was looking for the staircase down to go to the next level, kill, make money, buy new equipment, wash, rinse, and repeat. But it was just amazing. I remember one of the key elements of Telengard was when the game loaded, and it was off tape, I think, at the time. When it loaded, the title screen, it played like this wind sound. It was like this type noise, right? And the screen would quiver. It was amazing. It was like, whoa, how the hell are they doing that? You know, and it's like the screen would, you know, and the screen would quiver to the wind. And the fun thing about Telengard was, is that it was in BASIC, right? So you could actually hit run stop and look through the code. Now, granted, when I was, that was like 84, so I was 14, 15. I was no savant, coding savant at that point. So I didn't really know what I was looking for, but I was able to find this poke that would actually offset the screen. And so based on that, what value you poked in there would offset the screen a little bit more, right? So by literally poking random values up to 255 into this, you could make the screen look like it was quivering. So I figured that out. But Telengard, I mean, forget about that. I mean, the game itself was just completely alluring. I mean, constantly, hours after hours after hours after hours. SSI was also responsible for Questron 2, which was the prequel, so to speak, or the earlier version of Legacy of the Ancients, which, of course, as you know, I feel is one of the greatest RPGs of all time. So SSI had some really interesting stuff. Now, if you were into, before I dismiss SSI from the list here, if you were into tabletop games, like from Avalon Hill, does that sound right? I think that's right. Avalon Hill had tons of these like Warhammer games and these games that you would play on a tabletop, these strategic games. SSI was sort of looking to be the company to bring those games to the computer, right? So just because I wasn't into them, I didn't want to dismiss the fact that SSI was responsible for bringing a lot of those strategic board games or tabletop games, as they are called, to the computer. Next up is a little company called Synapse, and a lot of people don't remember Synapse, but they definitely remember the games. For Synapse, I have three games listed. Two of them a lot of people remember, one of them very few people remember. The most memorable one from all the lists that I've seen, from all of the research that I've done, is Fort Apocalypse. Fort Apocalypse is a freaking brilliant game. It has you in an attack chopper. It's a multi, four-directional scrolling game with huge levels that you would fly through. Caverns, guys to rescue, pratfalls to get through. I mean, it's an insane game. It represented a larger experience. It wasn't just it was something that was almost the depth of the game in terms of how big this world was you were playing on. And it was good action. It was good, solid action. It was hard, but not too hard. You had to refuel. Fantastic game. And if you look at most of the great, the top lists of all times, you'll find out that most people agree that it belongs in the top of the food chain. Also, they created a really quirky isometric scrolling arcade-style game called Blue Max. And it was a flight simulator which had you flying across like the German countryside, and you could drop bombs, you could shoot down planes. It was a great game. It's very neat. It's sort of like Zaxxon, only World War II style. The other weird game that Synapse put out that a lot of people do not recognize, which sort of works in the same way as Fort Apocalypse, but a little less action, was Zeppelin. This had you taking this, obviously a Zeppelin, a big giant balloon, through these incredibly treacherous caverns. There were switches to hit, multiple directions, multiple outcomes. You could pick up keys. It's a fantastically unusual game that if you've never played it, it's worth your time to actually dig up a Commodore 64 emulator and put Zeppelin up. Again, a lot of people have never heard of it, less people have played it, and I think it's one of those games that really, to me, defined who Synapse was and put them on the map, along, of course, with Fort Apocalypse. Let's move on to Broderbund. The Broderbund's the last of the companies we're going to actually talk specifically about, although I do have a great list of one-off games I want to talk about. Broderbund was responsible for of course, a lot of Apple II games, and a lot of Apple II games got ported over. Now, of the top-level games that you're going to know of Broderbund, right? The Choplifter, of course, Load Runner, the infamously misspoken Karateka or Karateka, however you want to pronounce it. Listen, I've been through this a million times, okay? I don't care what it's actually called. I'm calling it by the name that they had on the television advertisement. And on the ad for the game, they called it Karateka. I will always call it Karateka. And Jordan Mechner can come to my house and say, Dillhole, it is not Karateka, it's Karateka. And I'm going to still call it Karateka because I'll tell Jordan that if he was silly enough to let Broderbund put out a commercial with his game spoken incorrectly, he deserved to have his game spoken incorrectly or mispronounced. So, Karateka, of course. A couple of other games that a lot of people don't remember are Broderbund games, which are fantastic games in their own right. David's Midnight Magic. Now, I'm really into pinball, obviously, and I love David's Midnight Magic. It was second only to another pinball machine, which makes it in my one-off game section. But David's Midnight Magic is a fantastic pinball machine in its own right. There was also Raid on Bungling Bay, created by his name just hopped right out of my head as soon as I started talking about him. He was responsible for SimCity. Will, man, it sucks getting old, people, I'm telling you. Now I can't even, I'm going to have to look it up before we finish the show. But anyway, Raid on Bungling Bay, you can actually see SimCity in Raid on Bungling Bay. I don't think Raid on Bungling Bay was quite what he expected to do with the game. I think he was thinking more along the lines of SimCity, but Raid on Bungling Bay became a great game all on its own. It's simple. Will Wright. See, I was close. I had to look it up. That would have made me crazy. Raid on Bungling Bay had you flying from a top-down perspective, a chopper. You flew this chopper around, and you had to find these enemy factories. And you would have to bomb them a certain number of times, which you could never destroy. You could only carry a limited amount of bombs, and then you had to go and, quote, refuel and rearm your chopper, right? So the factories eventually would also rebuild themselves, right? They would heal themselves. And so that means that you had to bomb a factory. And by the way, the world was huge, this map that you had to play on. So you would go and bomb a factory, and then you'd have to go find a carrier to land on, replenish, and then get back to that factory so that it wouldn't heal itself up enough to where you couldn't destroy it. And of course, you had enemies flying all over the place, and they'd strafe you on your carrier, and it took you a while to spin up from the carrier, so you had to be careful. You had to watch the radar. Raid on Bungling Bay is a fantastic game, and I know it got ported to a couple of other platforms as well. The other game that really, really stuck with me, and I played this oddly enough first on the Apple II, because for some reason they thought this had some educational value, so we had a copy of it at school. It's called Serpentine or Serpentine, and it was it's like a snake game, right? Where there were a whole bunch of other serpents in the maze, and you would run around trying to eat their tails. And as you would eat their tails, I'm trying to remember here. It's been a while. But you'd eat their tails, and as you ate them, you couldn't head-on collide with them unless they were shorter than 3 segments. So you would run into them, and then they would drop eggs. That's what it was. They would drop eggs, and you would eat the eggs, and that would give you another segment or... anyway, it was a really fun snake game. It was one of the very first exposures to snake games that I had. And again, I played it on the Apple II at school, and then it's like, oh, wow, we got it for home, so now I can play it at home, too. And as you know from listening to a previous show, I'm really into those sort of snake games. And if they're done right, they're fantastic. So let's see. Oh, the Load Runner story. I'll tell you the quick Load Runner story. I've told it on the show before, but I have a lot of new listeners. So Load Runner, as most people know what Load Runner is, but it's a side view, almost a platform game, where you're a little stick figure. You're running around the map, and you're drilling into the bedrock, or you're drilling into the brick. They look like little bricks. And all the time you're running around trying to get these little boxes of treasure, you've got like 4 or 5 other little guys. They look just like you, only a different color. They're trying to come and touch you. If they touch you, you're dead. Now, you have this little blaster that you can blast holes into the ground. And you can actually dig. You mean, if provided you set it up right, you can actually dig yourself through large areas of rock. Unfortunately, if you don't leave yourself enough space, you get trapped and you end up dead. As you put holes in the rock, eventually the rocks seal back up. And if you happen to be in there when it seals up, you're dead. The problem with this is that the bad guys will pick up the gold from time to time. So even though you've got all the gold on the screen, sometimes one of those little guys are carrying the gold. So you have to drop them in a hole, and they'll release the gold when they fall in the hole, and then you take the gold. Even if you drop them in the hole at the right time, and they get killed by the hole as the hole seals itself back up, they respawn at the top of the screen, and you still got to deal with them. But they were so cool. They had ladders. They had, like, monkey bars, right, that you would, you know, hand over hand on some screens. And this was the very first game that I remember having a level editor. You could build your own levels in Load Runner. Now, this was back at the time we did not have a disk drive. We were still stuck on data set or cassette tape. So I remember, it's another Troy story. We lived on the south side of Wenatchee, and the store that sold Commodore 64 software was on the north side. And it was about 3.5 miles, right? We didn't have cars. We were kids, right? We were like 13, 14, 15, whatever. We didn't have cars. I don't even think we had bicycles at that point. I'm trying to remember exactly why we didn't ride. But anyway, so we decided to run there. Yeah, those of you who know what I look like now, probably trying to figure out how I'm running 3 miles to the store. But we decided to run. So we ran. And Troy, of course, was more athletic than me, so he managed to get down there before I did. But literally, we ran 3 miles each way to get Load Runner on cartridge. Now, Load Runner on cartridge only had like 30 levels instead of 100 like the disc one did, but it did have the level editor. However, there was no way to save your levels. So you could build like 10 levels, and that was it. As soon as you turned the computer off, they were gone. So that entire weekend, again, we slept in shifts. I would build 10 levels. Troy would sleep. He would get up, play my levels. And then after he was done playing all of mine, he would make his own and then wake me up, and then I would play it. We did this for like 72 hours straight over like a 4-day weekend. It was fantastic. And it was some of the greatest game time ever. And I'm telling you, the two of us came up with some of the absolute most devious Load Runner levels I've ever seen. Unfortunately, we'll never see them again because there was no way to save them. But Load Runner definitely has an indelible impression on my childhood and my video game playing. Now, I didn't want to not cover a couple of games that I thought were truly amazing just because they didn't fall into one of those publishers. So let's talk a little bit about what I call the one-off games, the games that really held merit, but the publishers themselves, maybe this was the only game they did, or this was the only game of theirs that I really liked. We're going to start with Uridium. Uridium was, and by the way, Uridium's a very popular game with the European folks and the UK people. Everybody loves Uridium, and why not? It is one of the fastest action, smooth-scrolling, parallax-scrolling, unbelievably fast, well-animated, shoot-fest, unbelievable. It's like arcade game on steroids. That's the game that you fired up when your newly acquired Amiga friends came over and they were laughing at you because you still had a Commodore 64. And you're like, hey, take a look at this. And then they're like, oh, okay, well, shut up now. Because that's just how good Uridium was. There were also about 4 different versions of Frogger. Now, a lot of people aren't Frogger fans, and a lot of people think Frogger's for girls. That was Sega's way of appeasing the girl market. I personally thought that Frogger was rather whimsical. It was fun, it was accessible, and it had great music. The problem is there were a million knockoffs of Frogger, and a lot of them were on the Commodore 64. Oddly enough, this is interesting, if you fire up MAME, right, an arcade emulator, and play the actual version of Frogger, the music of the first level of Frogger is oddly not present in almost any home version of Frogger. Pick your platform. Whatever platform you want, For some reason, that first little tune of Frogger is not in any of the home versions. I did finally find one that was not only a great game of Frogger, but also had that first melody, that first ditty that was in Frogger. And that came in the way of Sega's Frogger for the Commodore 64. And it was a great game. I mean, it looked great, it played great, it was almost dead on graphically, and it had that music. You know, sometimes I hate it. I hate it when music gets replaced in something that becomes so etched in your brain. And we've talked about this before, that it just doesn't feel right. It's like watching 16 Candles, the movie, and the theatrical release of 16 Candles had a whole different set of music than the home release did. But I never watched it at the theater. I watched the home version like a million times. So when I listened, when I bought 16 Candles recently, well, not recently, but the last time I bought 16 Candles, it was the all the real music, you know, the original music. And I'm thinking, oh, cool, I love the original music. But now I watch the movie and they have totally different songs where all the songs I'm used to them being. So, anyways, that's how Frogger was always to me. I could never really play a knockoff of Frogger, no matter how good it was, simply because it was missing that first tune. But, yeah, good game. Grid Runner. Yeah, yeah, old Jeff Minter. Grid Runner and Attack of the Mutant Camels, more some of the other weird-ass games he put out. He always had weird stuff, old Jeff. But Grid Runner was, I think I might have played that originally on the VIC-20. And then I got a copy of it on the Commodore 64. Very high action, high speed. You'd almost call it a Centipede clone, but not really. Fantastic game. Definitely worth making my list to discuss. Night Mission Pinball. Along with David's Midnight Magic and Pinball Construction Set, there was no shortage of pinball on the Commodore 64. But Night Mission Pinball was based on, it wasn't a real table, not that I know of, but it was sort of a night mission, like almost like a World War II themed table. It was just gorgeous. I mean, everything they did with it was fantastic. The sound effects were dead on, and it was really a good table. People who are pinball aficionados, you know what a good table is and what just sort of a schlock together table looks like. Night Mission Pinball was probably the best of the Commodore 64 tables overall. Spy vs. Spy. This is a weird game, man. I'm not even sure how to explain it, but we played so much of it that it's worth talking about. Spy vs. Spy was a room-by-room sort of third-person look where you played the white and black spy from the Mad Magazine cartoon strip of the same name. For those of you who are not familiar with Spy vs. Spy, the whole concept of Spy vs. Spy is one of the secret agents is trying to take the other secret agent out. So they build these elaborate traps and bombs and, you know, just crazy ways of trying to blow each other up. Well, in the Commodore 64 version, it was a split-screen game, which was sort of unusual. You played two players at once, and you were playing inside of this multi-room building. And you could actually rig up traps that happen when they open the door, that you could hide traps inside of dressers that they had to search, because you were trying to find something. I don't remember what it was, secret plans or something. So you had to search. But at the same time, your opponent was searching too, and they were booby-trapping at the same time. Now, you could both see the screen, but, you know, sort of a gentleman's bet that, you know, you wouldn't watch what he was doing and he wouldn't watch what you were doing. Very odd game, very creative game, and I'll tell you what, for a two-player simultaneous fun fest, it was really hard to go wrong with Spy vs. Spy. That was made by, I think, First Star Software. They were also responsible for Boulder Dash, which also made my list. The original Boulder Dash, and again, there was like 900 million knockoffs of Boulder Dash, and even First Star themselves made like 900 different Boulder Dashes. But the very, very original Boulder Dash is the one that I played a lot of. And Boulder Dash was weird. It was sort of like a Dig Dug sort of deal, but there was a lot more strategy behind it. You were digging through the ground, and you could loosen rocks from the ground, and they could fall. And you had enemies, and you tried to drop the rocks on their heads. But the whole point of each level was to gather a certain number of diamonds. And once you got the diamonds, they would the diamonds would open a door, and then you could leave, and you get a bonus for how much time was left. But what really made that cool was, I mean, one of the things that really stuck in my head, the diamonds used like copper bars inside the diamonds. It was a really neat effect. And it's like, wow, it was almost transfixing. It was hypnotic to watch that. But it was also a fun game, and I don't remember if the first version had a level editor, but one of them did. So you actually had that piece of it, too. Wizard of War on the Commodore 64 is one of the greatest arcade translations ever. Along with Satan's Hollow, Wizard of War on the Commodore 64 is just something you have to see to believe how good of a job they did. Wizard of War was a weird, weird game in the arcade. It was a top-down maze view with filled with monsters. Some you could see, some you couldn't. And it was two-player simultaneous. You could work together as a team and try to kill the monsters, or you could try to eliminate each other while the monsters are trying to kill you. Interesting game. Very, very weird. I mean, literally, if you were an epileptic, this game would throw you into seizures. I mean, there were flashing screens, and the music was crazy, and oh, such a weird game. But what a great version. I mean, it was obviously fun. We played the crap out of it, but weird game. And, of course, two more I've got on my list right here. Space Taxi. This was essentially a thrust game where you had a bunch of platforms on the screen, and you had a taxi. A space taxi, so you flew instead of drove, and little guys would appear on each of the pads, on each of the levels, and they'd call you, hey, taxi, and you'd fly yourself over, and you'd land, and you had to get your gear out at the right time, because when your gear was out, you couldn't steer right, so you had to get your gear out at the last second, you know, your landing gear, and you'd land, and the guy would be like, pad two, please, and then you'd fly him over to the other pad and drop him off, and he'd pay you, and he'd be like, thanks. This all had speech. That's why I'm doing the little speech voices. But then they had like levels where you had to move from one screen to another because the pads were scattered across screens. Space Taxi was definitely an enveloping game and one of those ones that I don't think I've ever seen done, remade, or done quite right as a remake or a redoing or reimagining. It's too bad because I think Space Taxi's got some gameplay still left in it. The last one is Bagot Man, which was an unofficial arcade port of a game called Bagman. Now, if you've never heard of this game, don't feel bad. Most people have not. Bagman in the arcade was a weird multi-screen, almost an adventure game. Platformer, where you were an escaped convict, and your goal was to steal all the bags of money on the level. In the meantime, a guard or two are running around trying to get you. And you have to climb ladders with the gold. You can take mine cars between the screens. It's a very unusual, original game and really, really hard. But somebody made an amazing port. I don't remember if that was Biganonia or whatever that group was that were famous for making those sort of ports. But Bagot Man, Aardvark Software made Bagot Man. That's right. We talked about this. Bagot Man was just a great port. I mean, it was dead on to the arcade game, and when you go from the arcade to home and you can play the same game, it's huge. That was huge back in those days. All right, so that wraps up my basic list of games and companies. So what I did want to do is talk about the top 10 games. Now, obviously my top 10 games are not your top 10 games, are not the neighbor's top 10 games. So what I decided to do was go to various locations and see what people voted on. There are many, many Commodore 64 sites, and many of them have huge databases, and a lot of them let you vote. So I decided to get a list of the top 10 games from four major sites that gives a good equal representation about what everybody liked, not just me. Right? We can be fair. So GameBase 64, we talked about GameBase earlier. I would say they're one of the more comprehensive collections of Commodore 64 titles. Here is what... Oh, you know what? I left a couple of games off my list. That's weird. I skipped ahead down to Boulder Dash and missed a couple. Before I go to the top 10, let me go back real quick. There were two other games that were on my one-off games list. One of them was Sci-Fi Trading Company, and I've talked about that in great length in the past. I recently managed to get my hands on a very excellent copy, an excellent box with the game. It cost me a little bit because it's a very unusual game to get, but what a game. It was a very strategic type game where you were in a spaceship and you flew from point A to point B. You were carrying cargo, and it was a simulation, so you didn't actually fly the ship yourself. You were sort of the captain, and all of the different areas of the spaceship were filled by crew you chose, right? You have a navigator, you have a weapons guy, you have a life support dude, you've got a navigator. So you have all of these different roles, and you fill them with a cast of people before the mission. You hire them. And they each have their own specialities, right? Some of them are really good under fire. Some of them tend to ignore your orders. You know, they're a little bit prudish. If you hire a robot, the robot won't fail if the atmosphere conditions go bad in the ship. And so as you're flying from A to B, you get enemies come in and start firing at you. So you have to control, you have to, you know, get the weapons guy to do his job. As you take damage, you've got to get repair robots sent out. It's really an interesting game, and if you're into that sort of strategic thing, it's worth a look. Again, it's really hard to get your hands on one legit if you want to own one, but it's a freaking awesome game. Bruce Lee was the other one that was on my list, and I just noticed that because I was looking at the game-based list, and it's like, I thought I talked about Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee is an adventure game, a multi-screen side-view adventure game that features you as Bruce Lee taking on hordes of enemies. And it's also a little puzzle-solving. It was the same group that did, it was Datasoft, I believe. They did Zorro, they did The Goonies, they did a whole handful of games, and they all kind of used the same engine. And so you would have to find ways to open this door, you would have to avoid this pit, you'd have to... It was, like I said, it was a really neat adventure game, and one of those ones that, as you'll find out soon, made a lot of lists. So, sorry, I didn't mean to backtrack on you there, but I just realized that when I talk Spy vs. Spy and Boulder Dash, I skipped those two. Okay, so let's go back to our top 10 game list from four sources. GameBase 64, Moby Games, Lemon 64, and C64 Wiki. So we're going to start with GameBase 64. I believe these are in order, although I did not... I think they're in order from 1 to 10. All right, so as appropriate. So GameBase 64 lists the top 10 games as Boulder Dash took the top spot, followed by Impossible Mission, then Summer Games, followed by Bubble Bobble, a great arcade port, by the way, if you're into that game, Bruce Lee, Great Gianna Sisters, which is a perfect knockoff of Super Mario Brothers, Pirates, Ghostbusters, Wonder Boy, which is a good platformer, but wasn't my cup of tea, and Summer Games 2. So you'll notice that the game series got two entries in that list, as well as several games that I also mentioned, Boulder Dash, Impossible Mission, Bruce Lee, Ghostbusters, and of course the game series. Let's go to Moby Games. Moby Games, their top 10 games are Whizball, which is an interesting game. I didn't play it a lot, but I did play it. Pirates, again, makes the list. Eurydium, which we've mentioned. Keith Van Aron's Pro Soccer. I've never even heard of that game. So, Zoids. Last Ninja 3. Last Ninja is a very popular game series. I never got it myself. It was never something that I enjoyed, but a lot of people love it. As you're going to find out, it's on the list a couple more times. Stunt Track Racer, which is a pretty good game, but I liked it on the Amiga better. California Games, Turrican, and Speedball 2. Interesting, right? Lemon 64. Now, Lemon 64 lets you get lists based on how many votes the game's got. It's really hard to make a top 10 list when you allow a game to have one vote or two votes. So I capped it off at 100 votes. So all of the games on this list received 100 votes or more to create this top 10 list. Number one, Maniac Mansion. Again, a game everybody seems to love but me. Pirates, again, that appears on the list once again. Zack McCracken, a game much like Maniac Mansion. Lots of people loved it. I didn't get it. Last Ninja 2. Now remember, Last Ninja 3 made the last list. International Karate Plus. Now, I did mention IK Plus. Fantastic karate game. So much fun. Ultima 4. Archon, Archon, of course, I mentioned. Defender of the Crown, which I thought was weird because that's an Amiga game and the 64 version kind of left you pale. Elite, and Elite's got a huge following. That came in at number 9. Elite's got a huge following, and I'm really shocked that it only made this these lists once. It was not my kind of game, okay? It was a space trader game. Everybody loved it. It had a huge galaxy to go through. Again, very, very popular. It was not for me, but obviously it made the list. And Turrican 2. Turrican made the list on Moby Games. Turrican 2 makes the Lemon 64 list. On C64 Wiki, we see a lot of the same titles. Maniac Mansion, Zack McCracken, Pirates, Last Ninja 2, Bubble Bobble, Boulder Dash, Great Gianna Sisters, Archon, Turrican 2, and Last Ninja. There you go. That's what those top groups found as their top 10 games of the 64 of all time. So let's go to the people. I asked on the Lemon 64 forums to give me their top 5 games in each of the publishers that I listed. Like I said, a lot of them chose to go outside of those lists and make their own list of their top 5 games. And I'm going to read a handful of them off to you right now. We're going to start with a guy by the name of SLF. He hails from Italy. His top 5, regardless of publisher, are Hawkeye from Thalamus, Iridium, we've talked about that, Creatures 2, Delta, and Bubble Bobble, a couple of games that we've seen. let's see, who else do we have on the list here? Dink, who's from Detroit. His favorites are Creatures 1 and 2, X-Out, Ghouls and Ghosts, rather, Double Dragon 2, and Blood Money. He also has a backup 5 nostalgic favorites, Gyrus, Sky Shark, Cabal, Demon Attack, and Kickstart 2. Let's see, who else do we got here? Hammerhead was really good. He responded to most of the things we've already talked about, but he has a personal choice. He is a MicroProse fan, which is somebody, again, the strategic simulation stuff I wasn't all that into. He lists from MicroProse Airborne Ranger, Gunship, MicroProse Soccer, Project Stealth Fighter, and Silent Service. Which is odd, you know, Pirates is a MicroProse game, but he even says no Pirates because I never played it. But he also mentioned a couple of other games. Let me go through here. I think this is worth looking at. Activision, he mentioned Beam Rider, which I do remember being popular, Park Patrol, River Raid, Pathfinder, and Hot Rod. A lot of Activision games that I'd never played. Broderbund, he pretty much named the same things as I did. EA, he mentioned Fire King, which I don't remember. Sky Fox is another one that he mentioned that I did not. Chips Challenge from Epics. Now, that's pretty good. I played Chips Challenge on the Atari Lynx. It was a great game. Never played it on the Commodore 64. He mentioned Ocean as a provider, which talks Whizball, Cabal, Battle Command, Pang, Run the Gauntlet. Synapse, he mentioned also several games, but he also mentioned Sentinel, Slam Ball, and Survivor. I remember Survivor. That was a hard game. Let's see, who else do we have? Oh, Malcontent, who doesn't want to give his location. He lists SSI. He lists a couple of games like Wizard's Crown, Rings of Zilphin, Road War 2000, Buck Rogers Countdown to Doomsday, and Combat Leader. I told you, SSI had a lot of games going on. I do believe Road War 2000 was one of the bigger board game or tabletop games. For EA, he mentioned several of the same ones I'd already talked about. Also mentioned Project Firestart and Wasteland. Under Broderbund, he mentioned Spelunker, which I totally forgot about. Bad me. Spelunker is a fantastic Broderbund game that should have been on my initial list. He also mentioned Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego from Broderbund. Access, he mentioned Mean Streets, which is one that I did not mention on my list. Activision, one of the ones that hasn't hit the list yet, is Hero. He was also an Alter Ego fan. Good for you, Malcontent. I like to see other people love an Alter Ego. From Epics, mentioned Legend of Black Silver, which I probably should have mentioned. That is the sequel to Legacy of the Ancients, not published by EA, but rather by Epics. He also mentioned Pit Stop from Epics. And from Ocean, he mentioned Midnight Resistance, Whizball, Parallax, I forgot about Parallax, Battle Command, and Hunchback. Let's see. Mac, M-A-C-C, from Stratfordshire, UK, mentioned Cosme again. He agrees with my selections, but adds Aztec Challenge, Beyond Forbidden Forest, Talladega, and Super Huey 2 to the list. Let's see, who else has some good stuff on the list here? Let's see, Mayhem, he's a regular. I think he might be part of Lemon 64's group over there. He's from London. From Access, he mentioned Echelon, which I never thought was the greatest game. That was the one that had the lipstick, the little voice-activated thing where you could fire your weapons with your voice. Under Activision, of course, he mentioned Alter Ego and Toy Bazaar, Little Computer People. He also mentioned Park Patrol and Spin Dizzy. And I remember Spin Dizzy. I think that was sort of a Marble Madness knockoff, if I remember right. He mentioned a couple new titles also for Broderbund. He mentioned Century Alliance and Sea Fox. Cosme, he mentioned The President Is Missing, which was not in the previous lists. EA, he mentioned Bard's Tale 3 specifically. And Jumpman Jr. for Epics. Under Infocom, he mentioned Zork, of course, Lurking Horror, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Suspended and Suspect. For SSI, he mentioned some of the Gold Box games, as well as Storm Across Europe, Germany 1985, and Vietnam. And let's see. Oh, Drelbs from Synapse. I forgot about that. Drelbs was another game from Synapse that he mentioned. And Mercenary, Slam Ball, a couple of new games from there. Mentioned a couple of games from Microprose as well. Everyone wanted Microprose on the list, and I just didn't have it. So Rick Dangerous 2, Project Stealth Fighter was mentioned. Let's see. I'm trying to find people that have their own little top five. Okay, so here's another little top five from Jolly Roger from Italy. Top five games of all time, regardless of publisher: Boulder Dash, Turrican 2, Maniac Mansion, Load Runner, and Whizball. All games that are respectable and made the lists. System 3 was another group, and I think System 3 published games, some of the same games like IK Plus and Epics published. But System 3, that was the Last Ninja, by the way, the group that published the Last Ninja. Let's see. So Thalamus got a lot of love. Rainbow Arts, of course, did great. Gianna Sisters, Turrican, Turrican 2. Let me see if he's got his top five in here. Here we go. His top five are Myth, Rally Speedway, Ghosts and Ghouls, Double Dragon 2, and Last Ninja 2. Pretty interesting, right? Let's see. See, here's one guy, Gert, said, too bloody hard. The publishers are all American, and even if I could squeeze in Activision's European releases and sub-labels, it would be cheating. So that's sort of how I kind of got an outlook to that. But anyway, let me see. Let me poke through this list here and see if there was anything that just jumped right off that. See, Troy from Edinburgh, UK, had tons and tons of things to say. Let's see. So he was a big fan of Houston. I'm probably not pronouncing that right. They're the ones that did Uridium that I gushed all over. Paradroid, Nebulous, Ranorama, Gribbley's Day Out. Listen, I know you UK people. I've played some of the weird games that you guys have put out. I don't get it. Jet Set Willy, never understood it. But there's a lot of games where you're being chased around by giant scissors and things like that. Never quite got that. Troy also mentions Ocean. He mentioned Rambo, and Rambo First Blood Part 2 was a fantastic game. Probably should have been on my list. Hunchback 2 was also really good. I just didn't put it on my list. High Noon. Oh, man. I forgot about High Noon. It wasn't an Ocean game, but that's a good game. See, this is why I have to ask the people. Gremlin, Thing on a Spring, Suicide Express, Wanted Monty Mole, Monty on the Run. See, some of these I don't get. Metabolis? I don't know. Anyway, he's got a whole bunch. His top five: Boulder Dash, Impossible Mission, Elite. I told you, people are crazy about Elite. Drop Zone and Gribbley's. Day Out. Well, there you go. So I wanted to make sure that everybody got a little bit of recognition there when we're talking about games. As you can see, American love and European love, the games were very different. I thought that was rather interesting. Well, listen, we could literally talk hours upon hours upon hours about all the great software on the Commodore 64, but I pledged myself I'd keep this at 2 hours, and I'm fastly approaching that time. So, I am going to have to say that's it from the Commodore 64 software piece of the Commodore 64 Anniversary Series right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Hopefully you've enjoyed it. Next month, we are going to be talking about piracy. We're going to talk about all the tools and the nasties and the goodies that people use to copy software, crack software, train software, what people were using, what was out there. And we're also going to be talking about the people, the names, the big names from Commodore 64, including some stuff about Jack Tramiel. We're going to talk a little bit more about him. Jim Drew, who I'm going to actually get to speak with at the Convex this year. I'm very excited. I'm hoping he'll give me a good interview. Paul Norman, Jim Butterfield, Mitch from Eaglesoft. I got a whole bunch of information about these people and about the tools that they may have created and software they've created. Should be a good time. Next month, we're also going to talk about some trivia around the Commodore 64, and we're going to round it off with stories. I've got plenty of personal stories about the Commodore 64. Some of them I've already told you, but I have many, many more to discuss with you. So look for all that on the next episode of Retro Gaming Radio. In the meantime, stick around. We've got more stuff to come right here on Retro Gaming Radio. This month's Bits and Bytes is filled with absolutely tons of great stuff. We had some really solid contributors this month. I'm very pleased. And let's get started, shall we? We have Simon James has sent us a couple of different items. Three here we're going to start off with. The first one is something called Remember 1986. This is really cool. It is a video. It's about 12 minutes. And its goal is to time capsule the year of 1986. The music, the TV, the movies, the video games, everything is included in this thing. And I got to admit, in reviewing, you know, looking it over, deciding if I was going to use it, I got totally sucked into it. I was like 6-7 minutes in, and it's like, wait a minute, I have this very short period of time to record. I should probably record instead of watch this video. But I got totally sucked into it. It's very lightly video game related, but anybody who was in high school or is cognizant of 1986, I don't think that you can deny just how great this video is. It was so well done, so well put together. Just, I mean, clips with music. I don't know. Check it out. I think you'll really appreciate it. There's a YouTube channel also. This was also submitted to us by Simon James. There's a channel here called Play Value. And I've never heard of this channel, but I'm going to be looking at it a lot more. He submits a video called College Dreams, The Story of General Computer. Now, I didn't know about this company, which is really weird. I would think I would know something about this. But in 1981, a couple of guys, Doug McRae and Kevin Curran, started a company called General Computers. And what these guys did was they took arcade cabinets and added boards to them to make them into new games. Like, they took Missile Command and turned it into Super Missile Command. And they did this by simply adding an extra board with more code and different graphics, different colors, that sort of thing. And it got really popular. They sold hundreds of these things. They were making really decent money. And so they started making these modified boards for video games. And this inevitably turned them into the developers of Ms. Pac-Man. So, I don't want to, you know, tell you the whole video. It runs about 16, 17 minutes, but I think you'll find it very, very interesting. Again, I got sucked in instead of recording. So here we have, lastly from Simon James for this month, he submits to us the C64 Drive. This is a Commodore, too much Commodore 64 on the brain. This is a Nintendo 64 flash cartridge. Essentially, the job is here to give you one cartridge that accepts an SD card or compact flash in this case that allows you to play, it's a flash cart for Nintendo 64. So you can check this out. I didn't get a chance to look at it very closely. I'm not really big into N64, and it barely kicks into retro gaming anyway, in my opinion. But I know that these sort of devices are highly sought after by collectors, so I thought I'd throw it in there. Now, this, on the other hand, our next piece, is submitted to us from Alan Pinion. Alan submits, this is really cool. This company is called Retro Heart, and they specialize in making 1/12 scale models of classic retro arcade cabinets and pinball tables. So they end up costing, I think, 25 pounds. So I guess you're talking about $40. But these are little tiny recreations of your favorite pinballs, your favorite arcade cabinets. They have little sound boards in there that have sound effects or audio that plays. It's a lot like those little Hallmark cabinets, those little arcade cabinets that I got from Hallmark that I was telling you guys about for Christmas ornaments. They have all sorts of pinball machines, video games. They've got video arcade game machines that have little 1.5-inch backlit LCD screens that can show still photos or animated GIFs of the game. And I'm telling you, I'm looking at these things and they look cool as hell. So apparently they got my Laserdisc games in here somewhere too. They even got Fix-It Felix Jr. from Wreck-It Ralph. So this is really neat. I'm going to have to order one of these, at least so I can like tell you what they're like. And apparently they've got Dragon's Lair and Space Ace. So, oh, look at this. They've got a Tron Environmental, a Discs of Tron Environmental. Man, I could spend a lot of money recreating a micro arcade here. So that looks, that's way cool. We'll give you a link to that. Here's a new Commodore 64 emulator called Micro 64. And the goal here is to make the most accurate C64 emulator possible. Now, this isn't just accuracy about how to play the games accurately, but also trying to recreate the screen, the monitors, the different types of environmental variables that might have affected the Commodore 64, the RF noise, things like that, that you probably experienced in your youth playing with the Commodore 64. So they're looking for that level of exactness. That's pretty neat. That, by the way, was submitted by regular contributor Martin Parrott. Let's see. Oh, Martin Parrott also reminds me to tell you guys that GameBase 64, we talked about GameBase earlier in the Commodore 64 anniversary section. The latest version of Commodore GameBase 64 version 10 is released. It's absolutely huge, even has more games. I don't remember what the count is here, but this is it. Let's see. 23,500 entries. There you go. So pretty much every game on the planet is culled into this, I think it's like 1.7 gig download. So if you are into full collections and full acquisition, this is the way to go. Very nice menuing system, installer, the whole bit. There's a couple of little quirks into getting it set up. I did it one time, I think for version 9, and there's always a little something that keeps something from working right, but I got it working eventually. These guys are huge at preservation, right? In fact, I just sent them 4 or 5 games that I had that were not in the game base so they could properly rip them and preserve them. So these are the sort of guys that need your help in keeping preservation alive. So every time I buy a lot of software or I pour through a whole bunch of discs, I like to make sure that I check with those guys and see if there's anything that I may have that they need. Now, Mortal Kombat is Mortal Kombat is not exactly what I would consider retro gaming, although the first one does date back quite a ways. This is just cool simply because of what it is. They could have done this with anything. But these are flip books. Do you remember those? The little flip books that, you get a stack of paper and you flip through them and you make little animations? 3 full rounds of Mortal Kombat are done right here on this link I'm going to send you that show this guy's flip book. Unbelievable. I mean, the amount of time and energy it takes to do something like this. I mean, it would have been better for Retro Gaming Radio if it had been something like Space Ace or Dragon's Lair, but the fact that it's Mortal Kombat is still cool. Several people sent in an article about the company that seeks to find all of those lost, buried ET cartridges in a New Mexican landfill or a New Mexico landfill. Yeah, I got like four or five people sent that one in. Keith Haddad, who also sent in that Mortal Kombat flipbook, along with Jonathan Doyen, were the first couple that sent that in. So the concept here is the rumor mill, of course, is that millions of copies of the most horrible video game of all time, the Atari 2600 version of E.T., the extraterrestrial, supposedly was buried in a landfill in New Mexico. This was years upon years upon years upon years ago, right? So the question is, are they still there and can we find them? So we've got a group here that is going to try to find all of those cartridges and see if it's true. So the name of the company is called Fuel Industries. They're trying to do that. And I've got a couple of different articles that I'll post here for you, each with a couple of different views on that. So that's cool. Next up, Captain Rufus sends in a Laser Craze article. You guys know I'm a huge fan of Laserdisc games, Space Ace, Dragon's Lair. So this is an article that's designed to talk about how this all came together, how it worked, how the craze worked, what was what were the spin-off things like Mach 3 and Begada's Battle, or Bega's Battle, rather. Anyway, it talks about the hardware. It talks about Thayer's Quest. It's got a lot of interesting stuff on it. I think even non-fans would find this interesting. So definitely check that out. Okay, so that's the Laser Craze. That, again, was Captain Rufus. Thanks for sending that in. Next up, we have Us versus Them, which, by the way, is a Laserdisc game, sends us in a link to, hang on a second here, I lost my train of thought. There it is. Okay, so he sends us over a panorama, which is a 360-degree interactive panoramic of Michael Jackson's video game collection. Now, you know Michael Jackson, you know, had some sort of an issue with being a kid, and so he made arcades and carnivals in his backyard and the whole bit, Never Never Land. So these are 360-degree panoramics of Michael Jackson's arcade, and I'm telling you what, whether you're into Michael Jackson or not or anything, it's amazing to see what all's in this unbelievable, like I said, it's one of those sort of VR sort of deals. But everything from pinballs to video games to Zoltar machines, you name it, it's in this guy's house. So this Pinsane or Pinorama is it's amazing. There's like 10 of them. You can go through it. You have to use Flash to get to it, so it probably won't work on your tablet. But very cool all the same. That was really, really interesting to look at that. Let's see. There is a new version of the game-centric fork of WinUAE. Now, WinUAE, of course, is the Amiga emulator, and there is a group of people that take, because this is open source stuff, right? WinUAE is open source. So they're trying to, this group is focusing on the gaming aspect of the Amiga. So they're trying to create a version of UAE that is very, very focused purely on gaming. So there's a new version of that out. That comes compliments of Martin Parrott. He lets us know about that as well. Let's see, what else do I have here? This is pretty good. Martin Parrott sent this in too. As you know, HTML5 and the entire ability to use canvas and drawings, HTML5 has become this huge deal, along with powered by JavaScript and all these JavaScript libraries. This individual, and I don't have his name in front of me, they have created, get this, we just talked about this, Impossible Mission. The game Impossible Mission has been completely recreated using JavaScript and HTML5. the entire game, and it's right here in your browser for you to play. How about that, right? It just amazes me what people are able to do. And it's right here. The whole game is like right here. And you can play it. I don't know. You'll just check it out. I think you'll find it amazing. It's the exact game. It's everything that you remembered, and it's all done straight up. Absolutely crazy. So check that out. Impossible Mission, done totally in JavaScript and HTML5. Absolutely crazy. Let's see here. What's next? Captain Rufus has something else for us. Let's see. What do we have here? Someone made a Donkey Kong arcade barrel. I don't think this link works anymore. I was dying to see the arcade barrel, but you know what? Sometimes that's just the way things go. Content gets old over time, and since I've been a little delayed in getting the show out, I'm afraid that didn't work out. But maybe Captain Rufus can send that back to us again. I'm going to nuke it from the lineup, but again, I'm sure that we'll see it in the future. All right, I got one last thing here for Bits and Bytes. This is a Kickstarter project called The Untold History of Japanese Game Developers. Now, this was sent to me a couple of months back. The person doing this, I'm so sorry, he even told me how to pronounce his name, but it's going to be a struggle for me. John Chipchisniak. Hang on a second. He wrote this down for me, and I still can't do it. This is how crazy I am with names. Chipaniak. I hope I'm close. Anyway, I'm going to give you a link. You can find out and see if you can pronounce it. He is a British freelance writer, and he's worked for Retro Gamer Magazine, Hardcore Gaming, Games TM, stuff that we've all heard of. And he was actually a staff writer at Retro Gamer at the same time I was writing my monthly column. Anyway, he is working on a book called The Untold History of Japanese Game Developers. He's really, really big into gaming and gaming history, especially the Japanese side, which I truly believe doesn't get enough attention here in the U.S. So he wants to write a book. He's using it as a Kickstarter. He's trying to get publicity generated online, and many people, fellow writers like Ashley Day, who of course has contributed and helped me out in the past getting articles printed, he mutual friend of ours, and so he sent him my way hoping to get some good publicity churned up for this Kickstarter project. And it made its Kickstarter. This is an older project, so it was funded properly. He was looking for $50,000. He managed to get $70,000. And I'm sorry that I wasn't able to get him more pledges, but I do think that we can definitely get him some backing for this and get some more information out. And he's got interviews on board. There's 40 different developers. I am not as big of a Japanese developer aficionado. As most of you know, I spent most of my early gaming time in American computers, right? Commodore 64, Amiga, where a lot of people jumped to NES and Super Nintendo. I stuck around on the PC side, so I never really got into the Japanese side of development. So this looks absolutely fantastic. I'm sure there's still a way to get in on this. It was fully funded 5 days ago at the time of recording of the show. So I'm really glad that he made the funding, and it wasn't because I didn't get a show out in time to get him help that he didn't get it. So please give some support. Drop the guy a line. Tell him you love what he's up to. Ask him how you can help out, especially if you happen to be in contact with famous Japanese developers, past, present, and possibly future. That may be somebody he's interested in talking to. So again, John, I'm sorry I did not get this show out before your pledge cycle was over, but it looks like you made it even without me. So that's good stuff. So he's got plenty of developers on hand to be interviewed. So if you're a big buff of Japanese game development, I think this is going to be possibly one of the definitive books on the subject. So thanks, John, for sending that in and giving me a backup on your name, which I probably butchered anyway, and I do apologize. Well, listen, folks, that is going to wrap up this episode of Bits and Bytes for this Retro Gaming Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. Again, these are all articles sent in by people like yourself. So go to RetroGamingRadio.com, click on the Submit Bits and Bytes, and tell us what's on your mind. Tell us what we should be talking about. Bring us some exciting articles, and we will probably talk about them right here on the show. Join us next month for more Bits and Bytes right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Well, folks, I think that's going to wrap up this special edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Hope you enjoyed the show. Next month, we're going to finish off our Commodore 64 anniversary series, and then the show will return back to its regular format with all the stuff that you have grown to love about the show. And there's more anniversaries to celebrate, just nothing quite as big as the Commodore 64. Thanks again to all of our listeners, old and new. We appreciate sticking through this couple of months off that we got to take with regards to the show. Hopefully you're still enjoying the show and you'll be sticking with us in the future months. Got plenty going on. So, yeah, we hope to see you again on future episodes. Thanks again for all the contributors from Bits and Bytes. And, again, thanks for the listeners. Without you, we wouldn't even run the show. So, this is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio saying, until next time, keep it retro.